Hello, and welcome to I Want What She Has, a show that amplifies women's voices and their stories. I am your host, Teresa Widman. Let me say that again, Teresa Widman. And on today's show, I am extremely honored to get to play an interview that I did with a dear friend of mine, Shannon Donnell. Shannon is a nurse, and she is a nurse on the front lines right now, actually working in New York City. And last week, she had a couple of days off, and she so generously gave me some of her time so that I could sit down and talk to her to get her perspective and her experience about everything that's happening right now from really a bird's eye view of being directly in a hospital setting. So you're going to hear my chat with Shannon. Shannon has really so many gifts that she brings to this world. We didn't have a chance to go into all of them because I did focus a little bit more on COVID and what she's experiencing with respect to that. And we get into some of the medical talk around things, my curiosity around breath and lung health. But Shannon has been nursing charge for the O Positive Festival for as long as I have known her, working tirelessly to support care for underinsured artists and musicians. She herself is a talented musician and a vocalist and has sung with the Ars Coralis here in the Hudson Valley. I hope I said that correctly. So she might be sleeping right now because she's been on the night shift, but we are grateful for all of your work, Shannon, and we're thinking of you. And without further ado, here's my interview with Nurse Shannon.
Okay, Shannon, it's so nice to see your face.
Hi, Teresa. I'm so happy to be with you.
I feel so honored.
Oh, come on now.
So you got back from, how long have you been down, working in the hospital near New York City? How long were you there? You're at home for a tiny break, but how long had you been down there?
Yeah, I'm home because I had 3 nights off in a row, which is really so such a treat. I don't think I'll have that for the rest of my contract, but I've been working down there since April 13th is when this gig started.
You know, I know you, well, I think originally from O Positive Festival as nurse in charge over there. You know, things start to blend together of how we know one another, but I'm pretty sure that's where I first met you.
And yes.
I've known you as being more of like a traveling nurse. You've worked in, you know, at one point you were working in like Sonoma Valley in California. And so I thought it would be kind of actually cool for me to understand what your really like your education and your nurse background has been. You know, we originally were trying to get you, you know, to come on the show to talk about death and dying because you worked in, you were a hospice nurse for a while, right?
Right, right.
So I know that you've done so many things. So maybe you could just share a little bit about how it got started, how you got started, why you became a nurse, and what you've been doing along your nursing journey.
Yes. I became a nurse. Well, first I got a degree in music and I played the flute. I wanted to be an orchestral flutist, which I really do. I love that so, so much. But yeah, it became kind of clear that I didn't want to just spend my life in a practice room or competing with other people when I'm really not a competitive person at all. So I started traveling the world a little bit, living in all different places. And my mom was a nurse. I never, ever thought that I'd want to be a nurse, but it just kind of hit me in my travels that nursing is one of those things that's really universal. Like, it involves a lot of universal knowledge, like knowledge that you can apply to any human being anywhere on the planet. And that's something that appealed to me, really, just to be able to kind of drop into any situation and hopefully know how to take care of someone or help someone who's sick or handle an emergency, things like that. And so I was living over in Taiwan and thinking about all these different nursing schools to go to, and then it just hit me that the town where I grew up, which is Plattsburgh, New York, has a community college there that was like a mile from where my house is that I grew up in. And my mom was still in that house all by herself. And it just hit me one morning. I didn't want to move back to Plattsburgh, but it was the right thing to do, was to go to nursing school there at Clinton Community College and live with my mom, the nurse, and become a nurse. So that was 2002. And then I graduated in 2004.
How was nursing school? Did you find it challenging? Did you feel right away like you'd made the right decision? What did it feel like?
It felt really good. And I was lucky in that, I was single, like living with my mom at the age of 25, 26. I didn't have to worry about anything else except for school. So I was really lucky. And then, of course, at home with my mom, the nurse. So, it was definitely challenging. And then clinical, a whole clinical experience. It's not only learning a whole lot about the human body, but also kind of learning a whole process of thinking, nursing care plans, critical thinking, rationale, understanding the rationale for every action that you're taking, that sort of thing. It was a challenge.
But when you say clinical work, what do you mean by that? Is that like in a hospital setting or?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Nursing students in the hospital setting, exactly, following a couple of patients, helping to take care of them, that sort of thing. Yeah. The whole thought process is just, it was entirely new to me, that's for sure. But yeah. And then, so I graduated in 2004 and moved down to Columbia County and started working at Albany Medical Center in Albany. And they're in their surgical intensive care unit, which is their level one trauma center. They're an academic center. They do a lot of things that are very progressive and on the cutting edge and high level of care. So that was my indoctrination into being a professional nurse as opposed to being a student. And it was really amazing and horrible and intense, and I learned so much. I mean, those are the sickest of the sick patients in the region, and especially trauma. Trauma is so very interesting. But yeah, after a couple of years of that, I had probably experienced, I don't know how many deaths, like hundreds of deaths where you're actually like actively withdrawing life support, that sort of thing, and sedating people or trying to provide comfort the best that you can, or dealing in situations with people who are brain dead and then become organ donors, those sorts of situations. And it was almost always traumatic or sudden, or just unexpected. So I really, really wanted to experience death in a different way. So that's when I started picking up some hospice, doing home care and inpatient care for hospice.
Now, when you say that working there was hard and challenging, and I imagine that it's both like physically and emotionally hard. And, I don't know if you can think back to those times and whether or not there were ways that you learned to help yourself through that. Or, anytime. To me, my understanding is like when somebody's experiencing a trauma, you're kind of experiencing it with them. I almost think of it as like an actor, right, who's taking on a role. It's like you're almost, that's imprinting on you in some way. And were you aware of how it was affecting you at the time? Were there things that you did to try to keep yourself well?
Yeah, I think I was definitely aware of the intensity, and I certainly felt lots of emotions, lots of sadness. I felt really lucky in that I had a great support system at home. I was married, and my husband was great at being supportive of me. And also the schedule, when you're a nurse, is kind of set up so you can have, you know, work for a block of days and then have a couple of days off in between each block of working. And especially working night shift, it's just like self-care became everything. It's getting sleep and eating properly and getting out in the sun and moving your body, and just the very, very basics of self-care have to be a priority. But even with all that, and as well as I thought I was handling things in the moment, you know, certain things just linger and linger. And years later, I still have, you know, there are certain situations that still make me cry, and they always will. And I think that contributed, that certainly contributed to my need to take a break. Like, I've taken a break the last few years. I definitely needed to. Yeah.
So when you started working in the hospice, doing that kind of work, did you have to get any different type of training for that?
Yeah, they offer a wonderful orientation that is, you know, hospice and palliative care. It's a whole specialty. You could just concentrate your whole career, your entire career on hospice and palliative care and end-of-life care. It's wonderful. I would encourage anyone who's at all interested in pursuing supporting people at the end of their lives and in any capacity, as a volunteer, as a provider, as a music therapist, you know, to definitely go for it, because I had lots of wonderful, amazing, it's an honor to be with people at the end of their lives, you know, and help facilitate whatever you can, as far as their comfort, their wishes, their quality of life, whatever it is that their goals are, what their families need, those sorts of things.
So it was the kind of the relationships that you're able to have. I suppose is it different? You know, I'm making assumptions here because I haven't spent a lot of time in a hospital around nurses, but I've just heard, you know, a lot of criticisms of kind of Western medicine in this country is that you don't get to spend a lot of time, doctors, and don't get to spend a lot of time with patients. You know, nurses are, you know, have a lot to do and running in and out. And so I'm wondering if the hospice setting is different because you get to spend more time and form more of a relationship, or am I just making that up?
No, I think that can definitely be a factor. Yes. Yeah. It's wonderful when you can visit the same patient week after week and establish a rapport and get them to trust you and understand what they need and what they want, and help them with their, if they're having symptoms like pain or nausea, something like that, help them through developing a plan and evaluating that plan along the way. All those things are really wonderful. Yeah. Even in the hospice setting, you know, the nurses were sometimes stretched thin and they were driving all over creation. I would have to cover Columbia and Greene counties. I could end up in one corner of one county and then end up in my day having driven 150 miles all over the place and ending up in an opposite county of the opposite corner of the other county. But, and a lot of things with you know, hospice is very much regulated by Medicare. So there's always, you know, having to fill out this document and do this exam, and you have to, you know, there are a lot of rules to follow, a lot of qualifiers to meet because of Medicare regulation. So that was often a stressor, feeling like it was taking away from actual patient care because you have to check a box or things like that.
When is it going to change?
I know. Maybe now. This could be it. This pandemic could be it. Oh. Well, that's one thing. I mean, so I've taken a break now. And on top of the emotional parts of nursing, you know, being a part of the healthcare system in this country, seeing the disparities, right? Seeing how people avoid care because they're uninsured or underinsured, or seeing hospitals being treated like businesses, right? And bringing in business consultants to help rearrange management and rearrange staffing, and, you know, witnessing all of that certainly has contributed to burnout, or I think what we're calling now is moral injury. Because it absolutely gets in the way of patient care, which is why we're all there. You know, it's taking, it's businessification. No. What would that
like? It works for me.
Yeah, right. I mean, treating hospitals like a for-profit business, treating healthcare like a for-profit business. I mean, that definitely makes it very, very challenging to stay and participate in this industry. So I'm actually going through this whole thing of like falling in love with being an ICU nurse again, because so much of the bureaucratic garbage is like moved out of the way because this is a pandemic and it's all hands on deck, and we need to really like get serious, be serious. There's no time for BS. And patients are really, really in need, you know. Anyway, it's just been a really interesting experience for sure.
Well, and it makes me think, you know, you and I have spent some time at Healwell Kingston meetings, and there's some other members of that team who also used to work in, you know, more of a hospital-based setting, who were frustrated by it and left. I won't name them right now. But, you know, that to me is just, you know, it's sad, because then what's, you know, how do we change it? And I know that's probably why you were motivated to dedicate so much of your time to O-positive, to at least kind of amplify this conversation around changing the healthcare system. But do you have like a network of people that you can, you know, kind of share thoughts with, or does it just kind of exist, you know, this known issue with the hospitals and the business side of medicine? You know, is there a place that you can come to talk to people about how to move this forward and how to change the medical system?
Yeah, I think that there are. I mean, if you talk to any professional nursing organization, now I might speak out of turn. I'm trying to think of what ANA says. Well, nurses unions, for sure. The National Nurses United, they're the largest national union of nurses. You know, they advocate for Medicare for all, and so I'm happy to stand with them and to take advantage of their offerings around education and advocacy and lobbying and things like that, because they get it. They get it. And those unions have pushed for things like nurse-to-patient ratios, where, say, in California, it's actually a law that depending on the acuity of the patient, you know, a nurse's caseload is limited, as it should be, because if nurses are overwhelmed, then we know that patients are going to suffer, and nurses will suffer as well. And then the whole system suffers. So yes, there are professional organizations, unions, that are a voice for change. There are local actions. Who has it been with the New York State of Health, that whole thing, that's the bill that's been considered in New York State for years and years now. Then yes, O Positive, then we have the whole consortium in Kingston alone of people who are willing to and wanting to make a change in the system. And then, yeah, like through O Positive, right, we just tried to exist in this way where, you know, the goal is to show up and take care of one another, not to make money off of it, just to show up and take care of each other and get, you know, the threat of the bill out of the way. Just drop all those barriers and really just show up for one another. So all that feels good. But I did, working in a hospital can be very, very frustrating. I've worked in, as a travel nurse, I've worked in many different settings, big academic centers to little critical access hospitals to bougie, fancy hospitals who have lots of money. And the most powerful committee is the aesthetics committee. They rule the house. You know, worked in all different settings.
So you're pretty uniquely situated with a bird's eye view of kind of what care looks like in all these different realms.
Yeah. Yeah. And also very practically, I don't want anyone to build a hospital ever again without talking to a nurse. Specifically me. Just call me. Because I have lots to say about bad design. And oh, Lord. Oh, yeah.
You can send me an email. I'll connect you to Shannon. Yeah.
Talk to a nurse before you build an ICU room, for God's sake. I've seen lots of different settings, and I'm so grateful for all of that, but yeah, it's hard. Part of me honestly had kind of just given up. Like, I've given so many years of my life, and I really do love taking care of people, and I really do love taking care of really sick people. I'm twisted. I know something's wrong with me, but
no. How long were you? Did you kind of do the traveling nurse thing?
I started doing agency per diem in the Albany area in 2008. I'd been a nurse for just over four years, 2007. Sorry, and then I took my first travel contract in 2010 and kind of off and on since then. But yes, I've worked all over the Hudson Valley, then California, Santa Barbara, Napa, and LA area, and then Boston.
And is there a reason why you chose to kind of do that type of work, you know, traveling rather? And I don't know a lot about how nurses work. I actually have an aunt who's a nurse, and I've had some nurses, you know, connected to me, but it's like they worked in a hospital. I have two aunts that are nurses. What am I talking about? But you know, like they're in a hospital, they kind of have their niche and that's what they do. And it sounds like you moved about and did different things. And was there something that was particularly, you were drawn to that kind of career?
Well, so being an ICU nurse, you have this very specific skill set, right? And actually some of my girlfriends and I would complain that like there's nothing else that we can do with these skills. Things like, and now that the public knows, like running a ventilator, right? Or taking care of a patient who's on a ventilator. And other things like managing multiple IV medications in somebody who's critically ill and all the advanced monitoring that goes along with those things. Yeah, but the ventilator is a big one. Not every nurse in a hospital can take care of a ventilator and understand what it means and how to troubleshoot and all those things, but ICU nurses can. So it's more like, you know, being able to take the skill set and kind of drop in almost anywhere and be like, yeah, I can be here and work, and no, I don't have to go to staff meetings or, you know, get sucked into any of the politics or the cliques or the bureaucracy or any of that. I just get to show up, do my job, take really good care of people, go home, and then, you know, do some sightseeing on your day off or whatever, sleep.
Lots of sleep. So what, I guess, was the process that you went through in making a decision to get back into this work during this very challenging time? You know, what was going through your head, and how did you get to the hospital, back to the hospital?
Right. So, you know, I've been, like I said, taking a break from the ICU for 3 years now, 3 years in April it's been. And in the meantime, I've just been concentrating on O positive stuff. And then also had started taking care of a gentleman who has ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, and being one of his assistants, which is really so lovely and wonderful. And like I said, I'd kind of written off ICU nursing with no desire to really jump back in. But once I started hearing about this virus and how it affects people and the fact that it causes respiratory failure and what we call ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and requires people to be intubated, right, to have a breathing tube inserted and to be on the ventilator. And just thinking about what sort of impact it was going to have on us, to me, there was just no other, it's just something that I had to do, and that I'm willing to do, and that I'm happy to do. Really, it's just a matter of doing my part and just wanting to take good care of people.
Were you frightened at all about going into the setting where it feels very dangerous?
Yeah, I feel really lucky in that I was ready to go. I had waited for a couple of weeks because my patient was going to have a procedure. And I wanted to hang out with him and just get through that with him and then get a little bit of a grace period after the procedures just to make sure that he was fine and settled back into his routine and stuff like that. So I kind of, put off jumping into it because I was waiting on a couple things with him. And then, so I missed out on the very, very beginnings of it when people were showing up to a hospital and the staff wasn't protected because they didn't know what was going on, or, you know, some hospitals didn't implement the use of PPE that we call it, like a 95 respirator. And well, with this virus, we use a respirator and eye protection, gown and gloves, all those good things. To protect ourselves from inhaling the virus. So I feel like in the very beginning, either emergency rooms were not prepared or people weren't using protection initially. Hospitals were discouraging the use of protection until somebody was officially being ruled out for the virus. So that means that somebody could come into the hospital and still be exposing everyone to it before they decided to isolate that person. You know, there were a lot of missteps, and a lot of staff were certainly put in danger. And I just luckily avoided that situation. But right up until I went and started this assignment, I didn't know what I was walking into. I didn't really know what to expect, what it was going to look like, what the personal protective equipment situation was at this hospital. So yeah, even though, I mean, part of me feels brave or feels like, you know, I can handle, I know how to properly handle myself in an infectious situation, something that I'm used to using certain precautions with patients. But yeah, the fact that there's so much unknown about the virus, it's novel to us humans. You know, we still, even weeks now, we've learned so much, but we still don't have a good understanding of it. Yeah, certainly had a few moments of being afraid.
And did the hospital where you were working, did you have your PPE provided for you? I mean, there were so many horror stories that we're kind of hearing, at least on the news or social media, which I realize is not always fact-based.
Yeah. So what I've seen a lot of in hotspot areas, and what this hospital has done, is they give everyone a respirator, one respirator a week. And these are things that we were trained to use once and then throw away, because after you use it, it's contaminated, right? And especially we would never use them in between patients, you know, use them between rooms, those sorts of things. So it was this huge, huge shift in how we use this protective equipment in general. So this hospital gives staff one new respirator a week, and then you pretty much store it in a paper bag between uses. What I did, because I was not comfortable with that, was I actually put out a call to my friends on Facebook for N95 respirators. And I got a bunch of N95 respirators from my friends. So I went into the city with a huge bag of personal protective equipment, from Tyvek suits and goggles and respirators, like I said, and gloves, alcohol swabs, face shields, those face shields that have been printed out at SUNY New Paltz. So I wanted to be ready. I didn't want to put myself at risk unnecessarily. And so, yes, I was ready going into it. What I've done is I have a collection of N95 respirators, and I wear one per shift, and then let it sit for 2 weeks before I have to wear it again. But actually, I've had enough where I just finished my fourth week, and I haven't had to reuse a mask yet, but I've just been keeping track of the order in which I use them, and they're all hanging up and drying right now.
So then what was it like when you first showed up for your first shift there?
It was really so busy. The entire hospital had been turned into COVID units, is what we call them. You know, COVID-19 is the name of the illness that the SARS-CoV-2 virus causes. It was busy. It was really hectic. Every room was filled with a COVID patient. Most of them were intubated and on a ventilator. and requiring life-saving drugs to keep their blood pressure up. The staff has just been so busy and so stressed, and they've seen so much. So they were really relieved to get some help and get some relief. It was wild. I mean, these just beautiful, pristine units with, visitors had been banned. So there were supplies everywhere on tables, just spread out between rooms, and each patient's data, their information was written up on the board. There are glass doors that close the ICU rooms, and we had every patient's data and their whole full report of exactly what was going on with them written on the door. And a lot of calling the anesthesia team to help you prone a patient, meaning turn them onto their bellies to help them ventilate better, right? And then turn them back onto their backs supine. When that was done, a lot of communication with teams, the critical care teams just stepping up and working nonstop. I mean, it was just hectic. I want to say, I mean, there's some chaos, but the truth is that I feel really lucky where I was working, in that there's such great leadership and communication and transparency, that it's like every day there was an update about how best to handle these different situations. And you know, people were really, really working hard to get the needs of the patients and the staff met. But yeah, it was busy.
What was like the general feel from your colleagues there? You know, did you have a chance to kind of talk with one another, or are you just working the whole time? Did you get any vibe of like what they were feeling?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, as soon as we'd have a minute to talk about it, yeah, we definitely did. And these nurses, these doctors, they speak very clearly in terms of pre-COVID life and post-COVID life now, and what it was like, especially those first 2 weeks of just really sick people coming in and needing to be intubated, and just one after the next getting admitted and then being on life support, and you know how hectic it was and how stressful it was, and the suffering that people have felt, the choices that people have made, how hard it is to be a nurse and to be so busy that you can't give the care you want to give, that you're used to giving. Yeah, they definitely talked about it.
What were, you know, who were the type of people that you were helping? You know, there's a lot of kind of information that was circulating on the news about how it's, you know, older people, it's affecting a certain demographic. Who were the types of people that you were serving?
Yeah, actually, I mean, all age ranges. I had somebody under the age of 20. People, I'm trying to think if I had anybody in their 30s, definitely people in their 40s, 50s, and on up through, really all ages, causing severe respiratory failure, blood clots, causing strange blood clots, causing other organ system failure, like kidney failure. I know I'm not so in tune with the stats, demographics of people I think I have maybe anecdotally seen a lot of people of color who are affected. Of course, they, you know, you hear a lot about underlying conditions, and sometimes that was pretty apparent. But other times, you know, everybody has stories of people who were young and otherwise healthy with no underlying conditions also being severely affected.
And I don't know if this is a question that you can answer, but is there any way that you can kind of shed some light on like what actually happens within the body? You know, what's going on that causes somebody to need to be on a respirator, and then why don't they recover and they end up passing on?
Yeah.
And I realize every situation might be different, but is there any share information about that?
Yeah. And there's so much still that we're just working to figure out, right? Because it's been totally new virus of the human body. So I think at first we would see people go into respiratory failure, but a lot of people not even feeling that they were in distress, but having very, very low oxygen saturation. And they would really feel like okay 1 minute, and then just totally be in distress and knocking on death's door the next minute and require an urgent intubation. I think we've learned now that this acute respiratory distress syndrome that this virus is causing is not the typical ARDS that we would see in other infections. And they're trying to figure out why. One thing that there is some evidence for is that it's causing this certain, a release of a certain immune modulator, interleukin 6. And so then that then leads to this whole cascade of events within the body of the immune reaction and the inflammatory process. And then that inflammatory process can affect pretty much all of the organs in the body and cause them to shut down, cause them to be damaged and shut down. So then you're ending up with somebody who has what we call multi-organ system failure. And that's a really, really hard place to get out of. It's not easy. What else? Oh, yes, this certain appearance, it does something to the lung tissue where it causes this kind of, I'm not sure if I should call it pneumonia or not. Maybe it is. We'll see people will talk about ground glass opacities on the chest x-ray or on CAT scan. Just a very, very distinct effect on the lung tissue itself. So then that causes difficulty in that affects lung function, of course. But what else are we seeing? Yeah, blood clots, people coming in with strokes. Or
what do you
like,
think that is connected to?
Yeah, I don't know enough. I really don't.
I mean, I was reading something about, I don't mean to laugh. Ben, my husband, was telling me something his brother told him, which I won't repeat because I don't know if it's factual. But, you know, there's all this sort of like information, like something happening on the toes or the...
Yeah, right.
Rashes on the bodies, or now there was an article I think on NPR this morning about how children are having these strange sort of it's not like manifesting into like a full COVID response necessarily, but they're thinking that it might be related to it.
Yes, I haven't read that. I saw the headline floating around, but I haven't read it. I need to.
From like your experience working in a hospital, and you know, I don't know if ICU is necessarily, I mean, ICU to me, I feel like is, you know, heart attacks, strokes, car accidents, these types of things. how often in the past had you dealt with some sort of viral situation? Was that a common thing? You know, like we kind of talk about the flu and how the flu kills a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, was this something that you had experience with in the past?
That's definitely something that comes to flu was the first thing that comes to mind. Yes. Yeah. Being an ICU nurse during flu season, especially, I mean, every flu season sucks, pardon my language, but the H1N1 pandemic of 2008, 2009, that was memorable for sure. That's that virus or that the H1N1 family, those guys, how scary. Yeah, how scary they are, how they cause horrible, devastating illness in otherwise young and healthy people. Yes. And that we learned from that about cytokine release syndrome, or what's called cytokine storm. And those are, the cytokines are those immune system modulator guys. They respond to inflammation in the body. I think I'm saying that right. But in any case, that was the cytokine storm that would take out the really young, healthy people. That was scary as can be. So I think, but that just feels like the tip of the iceberg compared to what this COVID has been.
And how is it different? I mean, the volume, the pace, the unknown, you know, what is it from just your perspective? And this is not like a scientific, you know, explanation, but why is it different for you?
Well, let's see, we've had 60,000, are we up to 70,000 deaths today in the U.S. or is it at 65,000 deaths, and that's since the end of January, February, March, April, 4 months. Usually, I think we see like 80,000 deaths in a whole flu season, which would be September through April, September, October, November, December, January, February. Yeah, so I mean the volume, the virus itself is more contagious than influenza. So more people are being affected, and then the fact that, you know, the whole thing behind flattening the curve is that that we don't want a hospital system. We don't want our nurses and our doctors to be overwhelmed. I promise you, nobody wants to be a patient in an overwhelmed hospital system. It's just no good. But yeah, I think it's the volume of people and the fact that so much of it hit in such a short period of time.
And when you, not to compare it to the flu, because I realize that that's not a fair analogy, but just when comparing it to anybody who's not coming in, you know, with a heart attack or a stroke or a physical, you know, injury, somebody that's coming in with more of an infectious injury, from a treatment perspective, you know, are you doing the same things? Are you seeing the same kind of response based upon the things that you're doing?
Yeah, well, so I think that they've learned. I think the people, doctors are more hesitant to intubate at this point, where we really try to push it as long as we can on another oxygen source, working with the patient to prone them early. And prone them while they're in the emergency room, just get them to flip over on their belly so they can, their lungs can ventilate better.
Can you explain that to me? I've heard,
yeah,
I've heard some folks on the internet. I had like a really a panic attack or something, which I feel like maybe I found out I have asthma. Anyways, I woke up in the middle of the night and I couldn't breathe. I came down. I don't know if I've said this on the radio before, but I you know, I like took a deep breath. I had actually had a dream that I was on an airplane. Did I tell you this? I think I just, I texted this to Micah. He thought it was hilarious, but I had a dream that I was on an airplane and it was like, we were notified that the plane was running out of oxygen. And so we were all to like be prepared for it, although there wasn't anything to help us. So it was just sort of like, they were like explaining that eventually you might not be able to breathe anymore.
Oh. And
so, and I was on the plane with, Jada and Will Smith and their family, which that was what Micah enjoyed about my dream. But I
totally normal.
I woke up and I kind of like just took a really deep breath, and I had a ton of pain in my lungs. And then I realized that I couldn't actually breathe deeply. And anyways, long story short, you know, I came downstairs. I was like, Ben, I might have COVID. And he sort of like calmed me down. And, but I was like, this is weird. I've never experienced this before, this shortness of breath. You know, I just never have. Anyways, it's quite possible that I have asthma and I just didn't realize it. And, or I had a panic attack in my dream. I don't know. But I remember kind of going to this YouTube video of doctors or nurses talking about how you should sit, lay on your belly
and
breathe deeply, or do this breathing thing where you cough to like open up, move the energy in the lungs. And so what is going on with that? Like, is that actually helpful? Obviously it is, because you're doing it in the hospital, but why is it helpful?
Oh, good. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. Because your lungs are amazing. Your lungs are, I know, they really, really are. I don't know if anyone ever thinks about their lungs, but we all should. Because they're these pink, beautiful, pliable, you know, very flexible organs. And they're made up of like millions and millions of these tiny little bubbles called alveoli. And when you take a deep breath in, those bubbles open up. And then the oxygen molecules that you just breathed in travel through the wall of the bubble. I'm trying to show you and hold the camera at the same time. Travel through the wall of the bubble into your bloodstream, right? And carbon dioxide comes from your bloodstream and then through the bubble wall. And then you exhale that. And so the whole idea, and your lungs are divided into lobes on each side, but the whole idea is to get every single little bubble in your lungs to open up and stay open. There's something that happens if you're not breathing, if you're not taking deep breaths, or people who are in bed, or people who have some sort of injury can have entire sections of their lungs just collapse. And then that's less lung doing its job for you. So the whole idea with these things, so one of them is called pulmonary toileting. But what that is are things like taking deep breaths, coughing, taking a deep breath and exhaling through pursed lips. And then you feel that creates pressure, this back pressure that goes into your lungs. Things like that, pulmonary toileting, that instead of spirometer, anybody you ever know has had surgery and they give you this funny little plastic toy thing that has a bubble of plastic ball in it that if you take a deep breath in, it starts to float. The whole point of that is to open up every single little alveoli in your whole entire lungs, both sides, each lobe. So they can work and do their job of getting oxygen into your blood. So what people don't realize is that your lungs start just under your collarbones and then go all the way down, especially in the back, in your back, almost at the base of your rib cage there. And so people don't realize their lungs take up all the space, right? And in line of thinking about the pulmonary toileting, if you don't use it, you lose it. So when we have somebody, just think about taking some deep breaths when you're lying on your back Yeah, you're fighting gravity. And maybe, I mean, I see some people breathe and they just move their shoulders, and that means they're using this much of their lung space, just the very top. As a flutist, I was taught, and maybe singing in choir too, we were taught different ways of breathing, so we'd use more of our lung capacity. I like to think about breathing through my belly button and filling up the bases of my lungs first, and then the middle, and then the top of the lung. So the whole idea is when we flip somebody from onto their back and then flip them onto their stomach, so their back is up, what we're trying to do is oxygenate the bases of their lungs and the posterior parts of their lungs and keep all those little alveoli open. But they found that it can be effective. And whereas in other kinds of ARDS, it might be a last resort to try to ventilate somebody, we've started doing it earlier and earlier with COVID patients and with good success. So maybe you can even prevent somebody from being intubated and being on a ventilator if you're really aggressive with pulmonary toileting and something like proning early on.
My new word, pulmonary toileting.
Yes.
Pulmonary toileting. Just in case that phrase wasn't clear, it's a new phrase for me, and I'm excited to use it more regularly in my vocabulary. Thank you to Nurse Shannon for explaining it so beautifully. For those of you on the radio who are just tuning in, I am playing an interview I did with Shannon Donnell, who is a nurse on the front lines working in New York City right now. And she was just talking to us a little bit about lung health, and I am really super grateful for her explaining that in better detail. I wanted to give a little shout out to Micah, who's also listening right now. Thanks for letting me know that, Micah. I often get texts of people who are listening, which I love, by the way, but normally I'm just a little crazed juggling multiple things. But since today's interview is a little bit more relaxed for me, I got to enjoy the fact that he was listening. But thanks to everyone who's listening, not just Micah. All right, so more conversation with Shannon about to go forward right now.
Okay, so just I wanted to ask kind of one follow-up question about this whole respiratory thing, just to kind of satisfy my curiosity. I was actually going to become a doctor, by the way, but when I realized that I wasn't that good in chemistry, organic chemistry was my downfall, and I decided to go another direction. But I do, I'm, you know, curious about the body. I have lots of curiosities. So just to understand a little bit about, you know, why I've heard the governor talk about this, you know, how we don't want people going on a respirator. Once they're on a respirator, it, you know, it's not good. And I could make some maybe guesses about basically based on what you just said about that, about why that might be. But can you explain a little bit about what happens then when somebody goes on a respirator and why there are concerns?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really just complicates matters. It opens up the door for more potential infections, like people with a breathing tube in on the ventilator have a higher risk of developing pneumonia if they didn't have one already. Also, then you're requiring a person to really, people who are intubated and on a ventilator need to be sedated or at least provided with some pain relief, analgesia, because it's not comfortable, especially if you're really sick and you need the ventilator to do most of the work for you, as opposed to somebody who maybe just needs ventilator for a little support. these patients are really, really sick and require kind of complicated ventilator settings. So then we're sedating people and kind of like making them lie still in bed. And if somebody's sedated and then lying still in bed, then they're at higher risk for other complications like blood clots, like skin breakdown. We probably have a urinary catheter in them, so then potential infection with that. So there are lots and lots of factors. You know, not being mobile is not good in general.
It's interesting just kind of thinking about, even not that I understand fully what's happening in the body with like the cytokine response, and but it's like there's this really delicate balance of this symbiosis in the body. And
right.
You know, it's like you intubate in order to keep the person alive, but it takes away some of the life, which you need life inside your body to recover. You need that strength to recover. And, yeah. You know, there have been criticisms about over kind of sanitizing our lives, that we need to be in contact with germs so our immune systems get stronger, you know. But I actually read a pretty good article this morning that's like, you know, a little COVID is not actually a good thing. Yes, we need other germs. We need to be in the dirt and, you know, but you just don't know how you're going to respond to something like this. And so it's not necessarily like we want, you know, to all test our immune system with it, although it might be what happens. You know, so it's like this delicate balance of like having a strong enough immune system, you know, but also being protected, or like the cytokine yeah. response, which is the immune system trying to do its job, but overdoing it. It's really kind of interesting to understand. You know, if we go to that yin yang thing, it's like, where do we get to the line that's right in the middle of the yin and the yang?
Yes.
Okay. I won't go esoteric right now about the balance of the masculine and the feminine, and this is how, no, just kidding.
That's a great point though. Yeah, it really is.
Well, so you've been home for a day and a half or so, and how has that felt? What have you been doing with yourself?
I have been sleeping. Yeah. It's well, especially working night shift. And then after my last night shift, I didn't go to sleep. I got cleaned up and then hopped on the train and came back up here. I'm just all sorts of upside down. And it's really hard for me to concentrate on anything other than thinking about when I'm going to go back to work, making sure my scrubs are clean, stuff like that. So, but I just feel lucky that that I have this beautiful place to come to, and it's very peaceful. I live by myself, so I don't have to worry about infecting other people. And that I live with, at least. Yeah, eating. I concentrate on feeding myself, sleeping, trying to get some sun, exercising, stuff like that. Talking to friends, chatting with friends.
How do you feel about going back? Are you going back at the end of this week?
Yes, I'll work Friday night. And I feel good about it. I mean, New York is such a special place. My coworkers are amazing. I love working with them. I love being in an academic setting.
When you say it's an academic setting, does that mean that they're doing work to kind of try to understand? Are they actually studying COVID-19?
Yes. So there's a medical school there, and then there's huge research departments. So yeah, they're ongoing studies. Pretty much any study that you've heard about on the news, they are doing there. The different antivirals like remdesivir, even the hydrochloroquine and azithromycin whole thing that's being studied, then different, an interleukin 6 medication, and then just lots of data being collected, lots of observational studies, lots and lots of good stuff happening, and that's just amazing. So I'm proud to be a part of that whole process, be in that environment. It feels really good.
Maybe this is an unfair question, putting you on the spot, but how does it feel, you know, knowing that you're working with these folks who are, you know, talented, educated, committed, and spending a lot of time to really understand it? And then there's a lot of criticism that is kind of easily bantered about on online with news media, you know, it gets all wrapped up in politics and all of that stuff. And we don't have to have a conversation about that mess because we'll never unravel it. But how do you feel, you know, about the work that's being done to try to understand it and to come up with a plan for how to keep people healthy?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me really hopeful to know that all these wonderful, brilliant minds are working on it. Makes me really hopeful, and being exposed to that, I feel like I can understand and have faith in all of that. I don't know if faith is the right word. Have faith in the process, in the scientific process, in these experts who make it their lives to have a better understanding of all these special fields, specialties, special areas of study. What makes me really hopeful. You know, as hard as it is to really understand what's out there and, yeah, what's floating around Facebook or kind of like the YouTube clip of the week or... I know it's hard. None of us, if we're not epidemiologists, we should not be expected to understand the ins and outs of epidemiology. I get that, but there are trusted sources we can go to. I want people to know that there are people who are acting morally.
With integrity.
With integrity, yeah. Yes. And that haven't been bought out by some sort of evil force, or there's not some sort of, global conspiracy to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. Like, no, there's so much good work. There's so many people in this world who want to do the right thing and make people healthier and figure this out and take good care of each other. Yeah.
So another sort of, I guess, controversial subject is the reopening of the state. And, you know, there's a lot. It's interesting, you know, to sort of see how the progression happened. You know, New York probably could have closed a little bit earlier and maybe saved itself some of the pain that it had to go through. But, you know, I think everyone did the best they could. And some other states who really weren't experiencing the numbers closed really early, just, you know, like the same time New York did. And so I'm seeing, you know, watching the news and seeing the frustration across the country of states wanting to reopen. But just specifically talking about New York, where we live, how do you feel about the state reopening? And do you have concerns, or do you have advice, or do you have, you know, pleas or recommendations? You know, what are your personal perspectives on this?
Yeah, well,
pressure, Shannon.
Well, you know, I haven't listened to Governor Cuomo in a couple of days. Maybe I listened to him yesterday.
I'll just say right now, since I said it on the radio show last week, based upon when this will air, that Governor Cuomo did retract and clarify his perspective on emotions and saying that they're valid, that we just need to, though, not be overly moved by them. So thank you, Governor, for doing that. Thanks for listening to me. Just kidding.
Yes, yes, feelings are valid, of course, of course. Oh, I'm glad he's making a plug for the science, you know. Well, of course, I want to proceed with caution, of course. But I think what a lot of people can do is just be super duper amazing about hand washing and hand sanitizing and things like social distancing when you're out in public and wearing a mask. Just be really, really smart about all those things. Think like a nurse with your hand hygiene. For us, it's so ingrained into our behavior. Now it's like I have something unconscious just sets off in my brain every time I know it's appropriate for me to wash my hands. You know, I want everybody to think that way. No, of course I'm nervous because I see how devastating this virus can be. I see the suffering that it can cause, and I don't want people to go through that. And not only that, but to understand that even if an individual makes a choice to put himself at risk and get sick, that on the other end of that, there are healthcare workers who are taking care of the sick people. And sometimes, no matter how hard we try, we can't make things better, or people are going to suffer no matter what. Or, you know, even things like your healthcare workers trying to do their jobs through a layer of personal protective equipment. It's totally different than if I didn't have to wear a face shield that made the numbers foggy or made it so I couldn't really assess your pupils or couldn't really see where your breathing tube is. And it just complicates matters so much. So, of course, I want people to be careful. I don't want people to be getting sick. I think that it's time for a new economy, but our old economy does not work for everybody. And since when is it more apparent than during a pandemic, when we see that people really cannot survive without two paychecks, or, you know, people haven't been making a living wage for decades now, and, you know, we need huge paradigm shifts in healthcare. We need huge paradigm shifts in how we treat working people, how we treat families. So I'm kind of eager for big economic shifts to happen as well, and to kind of reprioritize for us, like, what and who are important. How do we help our citizens, or how do we help our population survive and thrive during difficult times? You know, really, what is valuable in our society? Anyway, does that answer the question? Yeah.
Well, it makes me think of you and I were kind of on the same page of, where did that go? There was something that I had shared on social media about kind of like letting go of, you know, lightening the baggage that we carry around, and
yes,
for some reason,
right,
it's not showing up in my feed, so I can't quote it. But what, you know, has there been anything that has been kind of a deeper revelation for you, or have you felt yourself change in a more monumental way because of this experience? Have your, obviously what you just shared are values that you have probably had for a long time. You know, mm-hmm. I can say that 'cause I know you. But is there anything else that has maybe become more clear for you in a realignment of your own personal values?
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's a great question. I don't know. I wonder if I'm just too in the thick of it right now. I bet some things will come clear to me. Yeah, who is we? Who and what really is important to us? Who and what? We don't have to. We're just the superficial and the BS. Like, what really is important to us? What really matters in life?
Yeah, it's been important, at least for me. You know, I realize that I'm in a certain position where I've had a lot of downtime. You know, some people like yourselves have been working extra hard. I don't have financial stress right now, so I'm in a bit of a privileged, luxurious place. But it has been important for me to kind of connect to a reprioritization of what's really matters, and to think about, you know, as we put our lives back together, to be, I'm actually like in the middle of this blog post that I can't seem to get done, even though I have plenty of time to do it. But you know, that whole elimination diet thing to figure out what foods don't vibe with your body, like, do you have an abnormal response to it? And I was like, this feels like an opportunity for like a major elimination diet. And like, what are we going to put back in? You know, see how you respond to it. If it doesn't feel good, you start to feel stressed out again, then maybe you don't put that back into your life.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. What has been doing us favors and what has not? There's so much. I mean, it's hard too to see what the future really is going to be at this point, isn't it? Like, it doesn't seem like it's just going to be some upward climb out of this. Like, we still have rocky roads ahead. So it's hard for me to think too far ahead at this point.
Yeah.
Instead, just really kind of embrace each moment that we have and do my best, and then try to prepare for whatever might come next.
Yeah, I think that's a good reminder too. You know, we get into a very planning mode, and this thing is teaching us a big lesson that we can't plan. You know, there's bigger things controlling the ship that are out of control.
Yeah, it's hard to relinquish that control, isn't it? It's so hard.
All right, I got another shout out. Kimberly K. Thanks for listening, Kimberly. I miss your face. I thought I would just add here before we get into my last part of my interview with Shannon that the phrase, the wisdom nugget that I was trying to recall that Shannon and I were kind of geeking off with of a few weeks ago was this phrase from a book that I read, and maybe I've shared it on the show before, that says anything we cling to creates a maintenance problem for us. And for many of us, you know, things have been taken away from our lives right now, which is part of my theory about the elimination diet, which I have my blog post almost done now. And it's an interesting thing to just contemplate about really being mindful about what you're filling your life up with. And is it important? And do you value it? How does it feed you? All right, enough of my chattering. Here is my last bit of my conversation with Shannon. We love you lots.
Did you want to share anything about, I know that you're not actively doing the O positive stuff right now because you're being a nurse during the pandemic, But I know that O Positive has collaborated to do a bunch of things online. They've been doing online meditations. But there's a mental health support line. Did you want to say anything about any of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it's just been so wonderful. Yes, doing the loving kindness every day, Monday through Friday, the meditations at 2:00, mindfulness with Sean Harrison and guest teachers. Yes, Teresa, guest instructors.
Yeah. They might be doing it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday now, but you could definitely, I'll link to O Positive in the show notes if you want to jump on.
Great.
I don't know how long they'll continue to do it, but it is an offering right now.
Yeah, so that was really wonderful just to see that so smooth transition into something that can really be grounding and helpful to people. And then, yeah, the mental health line. So that was a collaboration between Samadhi, which is the mindfulness-based recovery community outreach program in Uptown, Midtown Kingston, and then Novo, the Novo Foundation, who we love, and O Positive, and just to see providers willing to step up to the plate, and Samadhi, David, let us use, I mean, all of his hard work into developing Samadhi, and they already had a hotline in place, so we really just were able to slide right into that, which is just such an incredible, incredible gift for David to share that with us. Yeah, just knowing that that support is there for people, anyone on the front lines who needs it. You know, everyone is experiencing this trauma right now, something that we were not prepared for. And all of our various emotional responses are totally normal and totally normal at this point. So it's really good to be able to talk it out. You know, I've been in situations before, depending on the hospital, some have amazing mental health support. The hospital where I am now, there's a psychiatric nurse who rounds at night and just talks to people and says, hey, are you okay? Do you have a minute? Do you want to talk? Are you sleeping? Are you eating? How are you feeling before you have to come to work? You know, just checking in. And then other hospitals where we've just had to beg, you know, as a staff, having just gone through a super traumatic event, or cared for a patient whose care was just especially challenging, you know, just had to beg for a debriefing or some sort of support after that situation. You know, there's such a huge range. So it's so nice to see that support available to people now.
Yeah. And I think it's so, I mean, in my own personal experience, right, we all experience trauma, and so much of what we're taught to do is just be strong and push through. And certainly when you're a nurse in an ICU unit, you probably have to be strong in that moment, but to give yourself permission to, you know, kind of go into it after in a safe environment, to be able to go in and process the experience, I think is so important and really vital to your own wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And we can't overlook that anymore. That definitely has to be part of the paradigm shift that comes out of this whole experience. Supporting.
Yeah, paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before I let you go, you know, I don't normally play music during the show, but sometimes I do. And usually when I do, I play female artists. But because you and I have a mutual adoration Jim Jaynes and My Morning Jacket. Do you have a favorite song by My Morning Jacket?
Oh my gosh. Oh. Oh. So many good ones. Oh my gosh. Okay, let's think about this quick. Oh my goodness. Do you have any in mind? Oh wait. What about we've talked about this before. Look at you. You. That's such a nice,
wonderful. Like,
wonderful. Wonderful,
right? Isn't that the name of that song?
Wait.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Or no.
This is a defined citizen. Look at you. You. Such a glowing example of
glory. 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 Yeah, that's a different song. That's the perfect song.
Okay.
I will play that song.
Oh, thank you. It's a nice meditation. It really, really is.
It's a beautiful one.
Feels well, good.
Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Doing all the things that you do. I know that you do so much and really kind of being on the front lines right now.
You.
People are lucky. We are all lucky that you're there.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah.
And very much.
I look forward to being able to hang out.
Yes.
But I will be patient in waiting that out for the sake of everyone's health and certainly for those working on the front line. So
awesome.
Keep in touch. Keep us posted on what's going on. We'll share all of your wisdom and take good care of yourself.
Thank you. Yes, I promise. Will do. So nice chatting with you, Teresa. All right, Teresa here with a few final thoughts. I should have grabbed a tissue because that song made me cry. And Shannon's texting me that it's making her cry too. So good job, everyone who's crying. Letting your emotions flow, it's good stuff. Let it out, feel it. I wanted to share that we mentioned the loving kindness meditation that O Positive is doing. And they do it on Wednesdays. So that happened earlier this afternoon. The next time that it will happen is this Friday at 2:00. And actually Sean texted me this morning asking if I would cover it. Excuse me now for my hiccups. So I will be doing the loving kindness meditation for O Positive this Friday at 2:00. As I mentioned, I'll link to that in the show notes so that you can find information. Sean said that they will probably continue to do it maybe on Fridays. So just stay tuned to the O Positive Facebook page. They have an event for it. But their website also has information on it so that you can find out exactly when it's going to be happening going forward. And also, I just thought I would mention, because some of you are hearing this on the podcast and not live on the radio. And so if you're listening on the podcast, you didn't hear the song that's making me sniffle right now. But I will link to I'll link to some of versions of the songs on YouTube that we're going to play. I'm going to play another song. The one that I confused Shannon's request for to close out the show today. And what else do I need to talk about before we go? You know, one of the things that I mentioned was that I had been working on this blog post creating an analogy for what's going on right now with elimination diets. And
I'm almost done with it, as I mentioned, but you know, part of this idea is that with an elimination diet, you're taking out foods that you might be intolerant to because you're having some sort of physical reaction that's not feeling good. And it really felt pretty clear to me that you know, we're all kind of being forced into this elimination diet right now in our own lives, where a lot of things, a lot of activities have been taken away from our daily schedule. And while it can feel very unpleasant and it can feel stressful perhaps, and you're missing some of those things that you used to do, it's not often that you're gonna have an opportunity like this ever again. Well, I should say hopefully ever again, where you kind of get a big reset on what you want your life to be. What things, what activities do you want to have in your daily life? And, you know, a lot of people in this world suffer from various illnesses. And I think it's pretty common knowledge that a lot of people struggle with stress and anxiety. Adrenal fatigue has been a big thing right now for the past several years, which is just people being on the go all the time and not taking care, not being able to take care of themselves. And I say all this not as a way to blame anyone, because I realize everyone is doing what they need to do to try to take care of themselves. Oftentimes it's connected to financial needs. But I really just strongly encourage everyone, to the extent that it's possible, to really be mindful about what you're reintroducing into your life once things start to open. You know, here in the Hudson Valley, we haven't quite been given the full green light yet, but there are businesses that are coming back in certain ways. And I think in a few weeks, we'll start to see more and more happening. And it's going to feel great to be able to connect to people in ways that we haven't been able to. But I hope that you take stock of the good things that you were able to kind of cultivate in your life right now, as you were perhaps slowing down or perhaps had more time for yourself. And if you didn't have more time for yourself because you were actually working more and juggling family, maybe that's helped you see how to prioritize the things that really are important. And one of the things that I think is really vital is your own self-care. Really, how are you taking care of yourself? You know, if one thing this virus has kind of opened up is this idea that people who already have underlying conditions are more at risk for that. And so what are the ways that we can build up our own personal resilience in our bodies and in our minds? And it all starts with taking care of yourself, which means slowing down. And so I will, once I finish my blog post, I will share it with anyone who's interested. I am totally curious to hear what other people's feedback is about how you're going to kind of reopen your life again and what's important to you. So this obviously seems like a one-way conversation because I'm speaking on the radio and speaking out to you, but I really would love your feedback and to hear what's going on for you. And if you have concerns about how your life is going to be once, you know, it starts to get filled up again. So with all of that, I am going to close out the show today with a different song than usual. I do thank Shana Falana for her music that we played in our intro and our cloud beats that we play after every segment break. But in honor of Shannon, I'm going to play another My Morning Jacket song. Jim James wrote this, I believe. It is called Wonderful. And like the song Look at You, I also think it's a beautiful meditation and a really beautiful way of envisioning the new world for us. So thanks for listening, everyone.